to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. In this episode, we bring you a recording from a recent event that we held at the centre titled Text, Tweets and Social Change: How Can Communications Contribute to Development? For this panel discussion, we were joined by Oren Murphy and Matt Aboud from Internews, an international NGO working to improve media and information quality in developing countries. We also heard from two Australian National University speakers, Sarah Logan and Dr. Nicholas Farrelly. The discussion looked at the role that media and communications technology could play in political and social change, transparency and governance, with examples from Myanmar, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific. Presentation slides from our events are available at our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au. We'll start with the introduction to Oren and Matt's presentation. I'm going to begin by introducing our first two speakers. Oren Murphy is the Internews Regional Director for Asia. He's based in Bangkok. Oren is a communications and media expert with 12 years of experience in Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Burma, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Sudan, Lebanon, Uzbekistan and Yemen. So a lot of experience there.
Modest.
He has extensive experience in conflict and post-conflict program design, media development, program management and grant writing. And Matt Aboud has worked in media development in both research and project implementation for more than 15 years in Australia, East Timor, Indonesia, Sri Lanka and Afghanistan. He's worked for the United Nations, KBR 68H in Indonesia, and of course for Internews. His focus includes media, communications and technology in conflict, development and humanitarian response settings. And he recently consulted for Internews in Pakistan, Nepal, Libya, Kenya and Cambodia. And most recently, he researched the use of media and ICT in three Indonesian natural disasters, including the Jakarta floods this January. So I'd like to welcome Oren and Matt up. I think is one of you going to begin before the other? Or
I think I'll start.
Okay, great. So we'll welcome up Oren. And he'll be telling us a little bit about Internews' work and their approach.
Technology, right? Thank you so much for the introduction. And thank you guys all for making the time and opportunity for us to come and speak here in Australia. It's my first trip to Australia, so also very historic for me as well. So I'm just going to talk a little bit today about some of our Internews programming and a little bit about our work in Asia. Given how much there is going on in Asia, we're going to try to, I think, limit it a little bit to two case studies, in this case, Myanmar and Indonesia. So I'll talk a little bit about Myanmar, and Matt's going to talk a little bit about his research in Indonesia, just to keep things simple. But then, again, during the question and answer, if people want to hear, you know, other ideas more in-depth from any other countries, just let us know. So here is a little bit of background on Internews and what we do. I think you kindly read through our introduction, so I can move forward. Here is a current map of where we work. We have active programs right now in about 45 countries and offices in about 25. But total, we've worked in about 90 countries around the world. In Asia right now, we're working in 11 countries, and I would say ICT and social media is a core component of what we do in almost every country where we work. So as mentioned, we're going to look at two case studies today from our work. One is Myanmar and the other is Indonesia. I would say one of the characteristics I've seen for the ICT landscape in Asia, it's really marked by explosive growth, both in terms of internet connectivity and then also mobile phone ownership around the region. I mean, many countries, there's over 100% of mobile phone ownership, so it really is huge. I would also say another characteristic of the landscape that I've seen is that there's a real lack of uniformity around ICT usage at a subnational level. So even if at a national level, it seems like everyone, if you look at data on, you know, how many people have access to the internet at a national level, it seems like it's nearly uniform in many countries. At a subnational level, it's very, very different. There's huge gaps between urban and rural areas. And even in urban areas, you see wildly different types of usage and patterns. And then also, one other characteristic that we find is consumption of ICT is not necessarily matched with the corresponding levels of literacy around ICT and what it is, how it can be used, and so forth. And Matt's going to talk a little bit more about that in his research findings from Indonesia. So I've sort of highlighted some of the challenges as like a development practitioner, what we find some of the challenges are in looking at ICT for development in the region. I would say one of the biggest challenges is just that change is happening all the time and at an incredible rate. I mean, what was true yesterday is not true tomorrow. And year to year, number one, the amount of access that people have typically vastly grows. But then also what platforms are out there, what media people are using, what social media people are using, that also changes from year to year. So just as we become familiar with one platform or tool, it gets superseded by another one that's better, more interesting, more useful for people in different contexts. There's also another huge challenge is just given the variety and I guess the heterogeneity of ICT usage in Asia, one of the big problems for us as development practitioners is actually finding programs that are scalable and replicable. Often we can find small pilots which work quite well, but that does not mean that those can be rolled out at a national level or across the board or even internationally. Another huge challenge is actually using ICT4D in populations which are in media dark areas. So those would be areas that don't have access to conventional media or don't have access to any kind of connectivity at all. And in large parts of, many parts of Asia where we work, that's true. Burma is definitely one example of that, where there's huge portions of the population who don't have access to any kind of media. We do work in Pakistan and Western Pakistan, like in the tribal regions, where they also have very, very limited access to any form of media. And then I think the final big challenge for us is the regulatory environment. Often the regulation does not actually keep pace with practice on the ground, so you have very confusing, overlapping laws, which can create huge obstacles to the type of work that we do. In general, our approaches on ICT are varied. I would say the one overarching approach that we have is that we know that technology is not going to be a silver bullet for anything. It offers huge potential, but it is not a kind of cure-all. I think in the heady early days of ICT4D, people thought it was going to do everything for everyone, but that in fact is not true. We also know that we really have to better understand how people use ICT before we design interventions. We've done a lot of work on human-centered design recently, just basically to understand behaviors, because people often develop tools which sound great in theory, but do not match how people actually use technology. One other approach is that we have found also that while technology is great, technology combined with offline tools and mechanisms often works better, because in many environments where we work, ICT is not a core component of people's daily lives, so we have to think about reaching those populations as well. And then finally, in terms of our approach, I would say we try to do pilots and then iterate. We try to do research around our pilots. I like to think that in our programs, failure is an option, and a very strong option in many cases. But I think while we understand that many pilots might fail, part of it for us is actually really understanding why they fail, how they can be improved upon. So doing the follow-up research necessary to understand the context is really important. So just to talk a little bit about Myanmar. We chose Myanmar and Indonesia largely because I think they represent kind of polar opposites within the ASEAN context of ICT usage. Myanmar probably being one of the most far behind. Laos may now have superseded. Myanmar is the most far behind. But things are rapidly changing in the country. So it represents kind of an interesting case study for in a country where there's not a lot of connectivity, how we might be able to use it and what has happened there. Myanmar at present, this was taken last week when I was in Burma. This is at the Shwedagon Pagoda, which you saw on the previous slide. Why am I showing a picture of an ATM? Because ATMs just arrived in Burma within the past year. And if you notice, this is not a queue of people lining up to use the ATMs. This is one person using and seven people watching because they've never seen an ATM before. For me, it was just kind of a striking example of like, wow, people are actually lining up to watch people use ATMs. That really is a great indicator of where we're coming from in terms of technology usage. It helped kind of reinforce this idea. We have to be a little bit humble about how much we can expect from ICT in the near future. This is some media consumption data from Burma, taken in 2011. If you actually look at daily usage for media consumption, it's about a third of this. So this was, yeah, again, 2000, so we're about 2 years behind here. But you can see, so the blue is the total number of usage, the orange is urban usage, and then the green is rural usage. So you can see media dominates the landscape, but again, on a daily basis, people, probably 20% of the population has access to TV on a daily basis. And so you can sort of see, you know, TV, radio in general, FM versus AM, shortwave, internet over here, where you can see, you know, the total population is about 1%. If you look at the rural population, it's 0.1%, which probably could count as a margin of error, probably well within the margin of error, 3% for this consumption. So it is a tiny portion of the population that is actually has any access to internet overall. I highlight this because you would think with that, I mean, we often, when we're dealing with donors and we're talking to different organizations about our work, they say, well, you know, look, I mean, obviously TV and radio are the dominant medias, that's what you should be focusing on, because that's where you're going to have your biggest impact, which to a certain extent is true. But we found that internet and ICT, while it is small, it can have a really disruptive effect overall in terms of all kinds of social and political development. So this slide, I just wanted to show you a little bit of kind of where we were and where we're going. On the right, this is a mock-up of Flower News, which is one of the weekly publications in Myanmar. Up until about a year and a half ago, all publications were weekly, except for the government dailies. They had to go to the press scrutiny board, so you would send this off to the at the beginning of the week to the press scrutiny board. You would have these helpful editorial oversights that they would put in, like huge red X's through here. They'll reassign articles to different page numbers depending on where you wanted it to be. And then eventually it would get published and go to press a week, you know, at the end of the week. It was a slow, ponderous system marked by not a lot of insight as to what was allowable and what was not. So even before they ended the press scrutiny board about a year ago, I guess, is when they abolished it. Even prior to the end of the censorship, we saw some interesting trends happening. One of the publications that we worked with is 7-Day News, and I have their Facebook page here. Starting about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, they started a Facebook page, mostly as kind of a fan page for their website, and also to start reaching some of the diaspora overseas, because typically the diaspora got media from a lot of the exile media, like the Irrawaddy and some other media outlets. They went from about, when I first talked to them about this about a year and a half ago, they had about 20,000 followers. They now have 266,000 followers on Facebook. And basically, Facebook has become the default online publishing platform for a lot of media outlets. This other media outlet here, the SMMK, which is the Myanmar Media Group, they basically set up an online newswire. So they have no print publication. They only, all their journalists publish online on Facebook. And then they sell their stories to the Now Dailies and the weekly journals. But they basically managed to set up a complete newswire with really no infrastructure and just a Facebook page. So for me, this is kind of one of the indications of how it can be a little bit, the landscape can change quite rapidly. The other thing that which was kind of interesting about this landscape in Burma is that in Burma, again, everything that had to do with print, broadcast, so TV and radio, all had to go through the Ministry of Information, and they had the press scrutiny board. However, anything which was published online, went, the internet is governed by the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications, and they don't have the regulation to go through the press scrutiny board. So what we saw was once 7-Day News started publishing online, they started posting just their headlines and then having links to their full articles. And all of a sudden, even before they were able to have a daily print license, they were publishing breaking news every half an hour or so, or every hour. So they managed to evade all the press scrutiny laws that were out there and start publishing daily laws even prior to the end of censorship. The other thing that was, again, for Burma, I mean, we take a lot of this stuff for granted, I think, as living in kind of the networked age, and you know, we're all on social media a lot of the time, probably more than we should be. But for Burma, this is all completely new. And I mean, previously, there was only one set of opinions coming from the government through the dailies and the broadcast media. Eventually, they allowed independent weeklies to come out, albeit censored. once they started publishing on Facebook, you started having people sharing articles, commenting on articles. I mean, some of them, I mean, I think sort of in the early euphoric days of social media usage, you would have something like, I don't know, like 700 likes and 50 comments and 45 shares. So there was a lot of discussion going on. 7 Day News had a kind of an interesting anecdote about a year and a half ago when they started publishing articles around some of the president's biggest reforms, such as releasing political prisoners. They were signing ceasefires with a lot of the ethnic armies. They got a call, they're writing stories about this, and they were posting them online. Most of them got very positive feedback from the viewers of their site. They got a call from the president's office, and it was the president's staffers who told them that they were printing out both the articles, but then also all the comments that were associated with the articles, and they were sharing them with the president. Because they wanted to show the president that he had support from the general population for the reforms that he was doing. And, you know, I think no one was more surprised in 7 Day News to know that the president's staff was reading their website. But for me, it was also, again, this incredible example of how kind of completely inadvertently they were, for the first time, giving the president unsolicited feedback on public policy, which was really, I thought, quite remarkable. Impact on governance and transparency. Another kind of interesting phenomenon is a lot of the members of the Burmese government have signed up their own Facebook pages. This is Uye Tut, who is the deputy director of the Ministry of Information and also the presidential spokesman. He now has 45,000 people following him on Facebook, and he comments on all and sundry of what's going on inside Burma, political commentary. He comments on his travels with the president. He comments on different policies that are coming out. They publish copies of draft media laws occasionally, or at least articles there of it. He does some of family and friends. There's a lot of promotion of himself and the president and things like that. But again, you know, like probably 3 years ago when I was on a trip to Burma and was talking to some members of the media, they were saying, oh, you know, it's quite interesting now that we have a parliament because this is brand new for us. You know, before, when we were trying to look, he gave the analogy of, before when we were trying to understand what's happening with the government, it's like looking at a brick wall. It's like now it's kind of like looking at frosted glass. He's like, you can sort of see shapes behind the frosted glass, but you don't really know what's going on. But I mean, literally within 3 years, because of this, not only do you now have a clear idea of who's there, you have an idea of their opinions, what they're talking about, what their priorities are. And like it or not, there's this huge, incredible amount of transparency. I mean, Facebook didn't create this transparency, but I would say it's been a fundamental instrument in making things more transparent and enabling people to get a better idea of what's going on within the government. Oops, and that's it. Here's, you know, the obligatory monk with cell phone shot just to end the talk. But I'm going to hand over to Matt, and Matt's going to talk a little bit about the Indonesian landscape.
Great, yes. Thanks very much. I'd like to repeat the thanks for the invitation, the welcome here, the opportunity to talk. I'm going to run through a couple of research efforts that I've been involved in. One came out about a year ago, and it was looking at ICT and social media use in Indonesia with a range of small case studies in eastern Indonesia as well as in Java. And I'll also refer a little bit to some research that I just wound up earlier this year, which was looking at how communication flowed, as Ashley was saying, during some recent natural disasters, including the Jakarta floods last January. Just picking up on some of what Oren was saying, the numbers in Indonesia for Southeast Asia for online use are really, really impressive, but the numbers can be a bit deceiving. They're growing very fast. You can see here the Indonesia ISP Association, APCI, estimated 25% or 63 million were online last year, and that's a jump of 7% in just 2 years. Huge numbers of Facebook, fifth worldwide, on Twitter, fourth worldwide on Facebook, and mobile phone ownership has rocketed up with more than 100% ownership, so people owning two handsets. Some of the, you can dig into those numbers and they can get a little bit rubbery, particularly on mobile phone ownership. It may be like 30% lower, but it has been rocketing up very fast. But what I was looking at, particularly in the first part of the research, was how is this used? What is the practice online? Particularly looking at social change, campaigns for change, and looking at governance issues. There have been a few really high-profile campaigns or social campaigns in Indonesia, really resting heavily on online platforms. I've listed a couple of the most high-profile here. Coin for Prita was one of them. Prita was a housewife who sent a private email criticizing her treatment at a local hospital, and the laws allowed her to be sued for defamation and locked up for that. So there was a big campaign mobilized online, Facebook, Twitter, everything, to pay her court costs and get her out of jail. And this was really, really powerful, particularly in urban areas, but across a large part of Jakarta as well, a large part of Indonesia as well. Bibit Chandra is another one. These were two staff members of the Indonesian Corruption Commission who are coming under heavy political pressure. Again, massive mobilization to try and push back, given the public support for that corruption commission. So there are those kinds of campaigns. A few examples that really did mobilize on a large scale and had the impact that they were aiming for. There's also been social media use in some natural disaster responses. I guess the Mount Merapi eruption in 2010 is the absolute highlight there. There was really mass mobilization to support villagers who were displaced during that eruption. And that mobilization drew heavily on Twitter, webcams that monitored the situation, a specific interactive website with an interactive map, but also rested combining that with community radio and volunteers on the ground. It's a fascinating case study that I don't think gets enough attention in terms of using technology and humanitarian response. And there have been some other kind of mobilizations around humanitarian efforts that we'll talk about a little bit later. So you look at the numbers and you look at some of the high-profile campaigns, you think, okay, this is a real avenue for change. And it kind of is, but it kind of isn't if you're looking at political issues. Because the mobilization is almost inevitably around humanitarian causes. So Prita being a prime example, the mobilization was around paying her court costs and getting her out of jail, but it was not about changing the law that put her there in the first place. And that's a very consistent trend. Where it is a political conflict, people will try to use online tools to mobilize, and they'll mobilize people who already care about that stuff, but it doesn't generally spread wider. And that was explained to me in a range of different ways. Many people were saying that we're just really tired of politics and it gets partisan too fast and we just don't want to do it. We just want to, you know, try and help people the best way that we can. So that's, if you're looking at social media, online platforms as a means to change, then this is a characteristic of behavior that, you know, really deserves to be taken into account. Some of the things that we were looking at in this research is not just the mobilizations themselves or the campaigns themselves, but what are some of the broad features of general use. And I think Oren also mentioned you can get high numbers, but it doesn't necessarily correlate to high literacy, digital literacy. And we really found that in Indonesia. An anecdote, it's hard to quantify, but the anecdote was told everywhere. The anecdote was particularly around the use of Facebook. You might have noticed in the first slide of figures of use that the numbers of people on Facebook is almost as high as the number of people online per se, which is kind of a remarkable correlation. And when you dig down a little bit, you can see some of the reasons why that might be the case. A lot of people are online through internet cafes, but more and more people are online through mobile handsets with the expansion of the telecommunications sector. But a lot of those handsets, or a reasonable number of those handsets, have dedicated Facebook buttons on their keyboard, for example. And people will get online just through that Facebook button, and they won't realize they're online. They're just on Facebook. You know? I mean, I don't want to like really say that. I mean, some people were saying that maybe they think they're on the equivalent of MMS or SMS or something like that, but they'll be on Facebook without realizing that they are online. You could have a workshop with people, civil society, local government officials, ask them how many people have been online in the last week and no one will put up their hand, how many people have been on Facebook today, everyone puts up their hand. So it's an understanding of what they're actually doing when they're online. There's also, I guess, characteristics of how people form their identities online and how they interact. One example which I found particularly illustrative, for me at least, was bloggers. So in my context here in Australia, I think about blogging as, okay, I'm interested in a particular area, I'll start writing about it, I'll connect to people who are interested in the same area, we form a network, and it doesn't matter where we are. A strong characteristic in Indonesia was people would blog on personal issues to connect with people who lived in the same area and form a local group. It was very geographically tied rather than driven by interest. And then the purpose of making those connections was to meet offline. And a number of people said, oh, I've been blogging to meet these people, I've met them, now we're meeting offline, I don't know what to write about anymore. And their online activities would then be about promoting the local culture of their particular area and so on. And so the behaviour was quite different. There's been some good write-ups by young Indonesian researchers about this. Another thing that we looked at is the impact on people's lives in other ways, not just what they were doing online, but how that flows through into daily life. And often we talk about these new technologies as disruptive technologies. We don't necessarily dig into what we mean by disruptive, you know, changing business models, et cetera, et cetera. But disruptive means some people's lives are radically changed or turned upside down or impacted in quite dramatic ways. And that can include, for example, people who get mobile phones or hand phones, as they call them, for the first time, and then they have an extra cost. They've got to pay for the phone, they've got to pay for the connectivity. And there are stories about people then over-exploiting, for example, local resources to pay for those costs, whether it's cutting down the local forest at a faster rate, etc. So the technology has an impact on the resources that they can use and what they use them for. It can also have very strong cultural impacts. So again, anecdotally, because this has not been mapped on any quantified level, communities with very strong traditional practices who have perhaps even prohibited television from coming into their communities because of the cultural impact it would have mobile phones, and that impact is really strong. Watching videos on mobile phones, concerns about pornography, and changes to practices, commitment to traditional practices between generations because of that impact. So really, you know, way beyond what you post on your Facebook page, how does it impact on people's lives in a range of different ways is something that we looked at. Like I said, there was some research that I've recently worked on and is due for publication hopefully this month, looking at communications in three natural disasters in Indonesia. They were the Jakarta floods, which was we researched in the greatest detail. We also looked at a small volcanic eruption in Flores that I think is still ongoing, and also an earthquake warning in Aceh, but I won't talk about those. Looking at the Jakarta floods, there was some really interesting features that came out. It seemed to be a really social media disaster. I mean, Jakarta is the most connected city in Southeast Asia, in fact, in terms of numbers of people online. And you could follow what was happening in tweets and Facebook and so on. But if you went down to the local neighbourhoods that were flooded out, they've got mobile phones, etc., but they did not have the communication resilience, if you like, because even though they had TVs, they had mobile phones, the waters arrived, the power went out, and then the batteries on the phones ran out, and then they couldn't use it. So you had enormous amount of commentary, but it actually wasn't the people who were most affected. Everyone was affected, clearly. You know, I mean, you couldn't travel around the city, and there was a big impact. But the people whose homes were flooded out were far less visible online and could not access those resources to find out what was going on and find out what they needed to do. There were some other interesting elements there, building on the kind of experience of Mount Merapi, the eruption that I mentioned to earlier. There is now, a small cohort of volunteer humanitarian responders who immediately turn to social networks to mobilize a response among their peers. And so ODOS, One Day, One Service, was a network formed over Twitter and started gathering donations over Twitter and organizing distributions of aid across South Jakarta particularly. And so that has been a bit of a change to response, but it's mostly in the volunteer networks, not so much in the established institutions. Urban Poor Consortium, which works with urban poor, particularly in North Jakarta, they weren't mobilizing in that way, but they were definitely using social media to try and intervene in the media narrative to get the issues in their neighbourhoods highlighted in coverage and then drive political and leadership attention. So there were some interesting kind of, not from the community level, but from those who worked with them who were using social media in a range of different ways. Just moving, I'll try and wrap up quickly so that we can get to questions and discussions a bit earlier. But just looking outside of those areas, social media is having an impact on governance and campaigning. Again, it's not always as obvious as it might seem. There are a number of politicians across the country, at local level as well as national level, who have Facebook pages, and they use it to post anything and everything, but they are not connected, generally speaking, to their office itself. So they will not be talking about their office functions, it's not their staff that are helping to contribute, it's just them. And the outreach of the candidate or the politician is far more on social media than of the office, which is interesting because that kind of platform could really help transparency, and it's kind of helping it on the campaign level for the individual, but not so much for the functions of the office so much. There is an exception there, well, there's a few exceptions, but the most high-profile exception is Jokowi, who is the recently elected last year governor of Jakarta. He came to national prominence as the governor of Solo in central Java, and one of his one of the reasons for that was a variety of efforts towards greater citizen engagement in governance. That included meetings, offline events, but it also included social media, online events. And he brought that to his campaign in Jakarta. And he had a massive amount of followers. Now, some of that is rolling through in terms of how they implement governance in the new administration. And a very popular one, a very effective one, is his deputy going to the various government agencies and saying, you've got to do better, you've got to reform, and really, like, putting the burner on them, really, but doing it on YouTube so everyone sees it. Everyone sees them talking, everyone sees the reactions of the officials, everyone loves the fact that they look so uncomfortable. And so that's having a really knock-on effect. Even if people aren't getting on YouTube to watch it, they know about it through the rest of the media coverage. It's driving the narrative of the administration. Another area where it's flowing through, and we can talk about this a bit more detail if people want to in discussion, is in media practice itself. And I think there are some parallels here. There are cases where the social media narrative drives media coverage, but there's a lot more where media coverage is driving or framing social media engagement. There are a few outlets that have really picked up on that and are promoting citizen journalism as part of what they do. Compassiana from the leading print publishing house, Compass, is one, and Detik.com is... At first, people would laugh at them because they were purely online in the early part of this century, and who's going to read you? But now they are really quite big and have a lot of influence. So it has started, it has changed the media sector. It's not tied so much to the political changes the way it is in Burma. The political changes in Indonesia happened before this technology came through, but it's definitely changing the way media practice. Just very, very quickly, the other area, which is not so much social media per se, but it's online tools, where ICT is making changes, is in the government's own efforts to use these tools. Indonesia is a founding member of the Open Government Partnership, and as part of that is putting through various reforms, trialing various reforms, particularly at the local government level. That includes e-procurement, where all procurement happens online so people can see what is being bought, who is getting the contract, how much they're getting paid. Open schools, which is also putting school budgets and administration online. Open budget at the local government level, which is, as it says, putting that online so anyone who can get online can see it. They are really, potentially very powerful initiatives for government transparency. The issue that people are finding is that the local government can put that information up there and then they just can't cope with the questions. Like just the sheer resources. Their confidence in using the technology often, in terms of their individual skills within the office, but also just the number of questions that they get from the public. So you can put up the tool, but you've got to have the human resources to back it up. There are a few other examples. The one, Lapor, down the bottom there, is from the president's office, and it's a... It's a portal, it's a website, also a Twitter page, also a Facebook page, or a Twitter account, Facebook page, where citizens can report problems they're having with their local government above the local government, and then the president's office itself can say, hey, fix this. And that might be about, police misbehaviour or a broken bridge or whatever. It's very initial stages, but they are pushing forward some reforms. It's very interesting to see how they flow out and the kind of impact they eventually have. A lot of these are still small, not the open government, that's growing slowly, but they're still very... the government of Indonesia is putting in a serious effort and really needs to... it's really worth monitoring as we go forward. I can talk a little bit more, maybe in discussion, about how we try and translate that into programmatic interventions, projects, pilots, and the research that we do on them, but I might leave it there and wrap up on the research side and hand over to our other speakers.
Thank you so much, Orin. That was very interesting. When I lived in Jakarta, I worked at the Jakarta Globe newspaper on a web desk, and any time we printed a story out of Krita Mulyasari, the whole website crashed within 5 minutes. It was amazing. So I'm going to welcome Sarah up next. She's going to talk to us a little bit about the Pacific. Sarah's a PhD student at the Department of International Relations here at ANU. Her research interests are in the impact of the internet on international politics and the political economy of the internet in fragile states. And her work has been published by ANU State Society in Governance in Melanesia program and the Canadian International Council, as well as on Moe's Interpretive blog and Open Democracy. And prior to starting her research on PNG, she worked as an analyst at the Office of National Assessment. So, welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Ashley. And thanks to Dev Policy again for organising this forum. It's a new area, I think, in our region. In terms of development, so it's really exciting to have someone like Dev Policy supporting it by providing us with the space and the time. And thanks also to Internews for coming all the way to Australia. As a bit of a kind of a dork when it comes to these issues, it's really exciting for me, and I hope everyone else, to have people like this discussing these issues with us today. So a few of you have seen me speak on this issue before, so I'll try not to bore you with the same old story. But to be honest, there's really not that much of a story in the Pacific. The main part of the story that I'll be talking about is the stats and what we can describe as an incredible increase in access. But apart from that, there's not a whole lot happening when it comes to ICT for development, and particularly when it comes to ICT for governance. So these are the stats here. You can see that there's been a huge increase, comparatively speaking, in mobile phone subscriptions in the Pacific. That's the one on the far right. This is particularly important in the context of other sorts of media access. So as Oren was saying, a lot of this development is happening in media dark environments. So you can see the number of fixed lines per fixed telephone lines per 100 people is, you know, never beyond really 30% anywhere in the Pacific. And in some states like PNG, it's down to about 2 fixed telephone lines per people. So if you compare that to what is now a probably outdated figure of 34% of the population having access to a mobile phone, that is quite a considerable change in access. On those stats, overall in the Pacific, about 60% of Pacific Islanders now have access to a mobile phone, and that's up from about 8% in 2002. So again, striking. Internet access is still pretty low. It's slow and expensive in most places, although I have to say that Tonga's doing pretty well. They just an undersea cable landed there earlier this year and has increased speeds by about 600%, which is kind of impressive. But unfortunately, for everywhere else in the Pacific, not so much yet, although that is changing. It's still quite expensive in a lot of places. But these stats here that I've got, they're from the World Bank. They're out of date. So since 2011, in PNG, for example, we've seen deregulation of the ISP market. We've seen a few new cables come to land. And we've also seen Digicel introduce mobile broadband for the first time. And that includes introducing a Facebook phone, like Matt was discussing in Indonesia. So those stats are likely to have increased considerably, but unfortunately the World Bank is not going to be releasing the data until probably later this year. So the stat on Facebook access is interesting because it suggests that just because you're online doesn't mean you're on Facebook. Again, with the introduction of Facebook phones in the Pacific, I'd suggest that might change. But yeah, it's important when I think about social media in the Pacific. It's easy to get excited about it, but in the Pacific at least, just because you're online doesn't mean you're on Facebook. But Facebook was the Pacific was one of Facebook's fastest growing markets in 2012. So again, those stats, you know, I take them with a grain of salt, but they're all we have at the moment. So 5 Pacific Island countries ranked among Facebook's top growth markets in 2012, especially Samoa and PNG. Of course, most of this growth is driven by the 15 to 35 age bracket. But interestingly, men and women across the Pacific appear to use Facebook in roughly equal numbers, which I think is interesting when you think about some pretty appalling gender statistics across the Pacific, but also historical kind of traditions of access to media and information. There was a study done on media access in PNG recently, for example, which suggested that young women felt that they didn't control access to any sort of media within their home. They didn't control what radio station the family listened to, what TV station they watched, what newspapers came into the house, but they did control the information they got through their mobile phones. And that was far more striking for that age group, young women, than it was for any other age group. So, and those sorts of stats were also repeated to a lesser extent in a study that was done in Vanuatu. So I guess the key message here is it's increasing. It'd be great to have some new stats. And it's increasing in a very media-dark environment. So again, to go back to the example of PNG, you're having this increase taking place in an environment of very low fixed landline access, but also an environment with not even really a national radio station to speak of. I mean, technically, yes, but in practice, no. And not really national newspapers either. Quite strikingly low literacy rates. So if we're looking at new sources of information and their political impact, we have to take it in the Pacific in general, but particularly, I'd say, in Melanesia, as coming from an historically media-dark environment. So I just wanted to give some examples of different types of ICT use that I've come across in the Pacific. This is by no means comprehensive, but again, I think the message that I'd like to get out is that there's really not a lot happening. Things are emerging, but there's no sort of consistent explosive growth in ICT for dev applications across the Pacific. Things seem to be a bit patchwork. So this first slide up here, this is a woman in Milne Bay, a nurse. She's demonstrating a maternal health hotline that AusAid funded, which has just been expanded from a pilot. So that allows women to use their mobile phones for free to access maternal health information, either during labour or during pregnancy, and to allows health professionals to access that information as well. Next is an ad for BSP, Bank of South Pacific's mobile banking program. The Pacific at the moment is a bit of a hotspot for mobile money innovation, which I think is really interesting. That's due largely, I think, to a pretty permissive regulatory environment, a lot of work that's been done by international donors, particularly the World Bank. And also, I think, particularly for Polynesia and Micronesia, some pretty hefty diaspora populations and remittance-based economies. That's an interesting thing to think about. There's quite some interesting innovations happening there. But also what you have in, say, a lot of the Pacific, particularly, again, in PNG, is mobile banking is being taken up by people who've never before been exposed to financial services. So there's some pretty striking stats there. So in 2012, in PNG, for example, BSP had 320,000 registrations and 6.8 million transactions. That's quite striking. And that's with mobile banking only having been introduced in 2009. The image on the right, it's not that interesting an image, I'm sorry, but it was I was looking for an example of an app that was really to do with connecting farmers with markets. As we all know, that's a bit of an issue in the Pacific in general. There are programs happening in PNG with coffee growers and so on, but this is an example from Fiji, which has just launched. And what it's about is about linking local growers and producers with the hotel produce market, so allowing hotels to access locally grown produce without having to kind of trawl the local markets and, generally get stuff that's either out of date or not available, or look for stuff that's not available. It also allows farmers to get a good price for their fruit and veg and to hopefully move it on in a timely manner, hopefully sort of leapfrogging some of the problems with infrastructure that we see in markets like that. So along the bottom, these are just the icons which you've probably all seen before if you're at all interested in this issue in the Pacific. Most of the work on ICT4D in the Pacific is more this sort of stuff on the top layer, if indeed it happens at all. ICT for governance, so for transparency and accountability, is very limited, and it's driven more by users than by any sort of coordinated donor activity. So on the right, we've got Sharp Talk, a Facebook group, political discussion group in PNG, Forum Solomon Islands International for the Sols, and Human Talk Straight in Vanuatu. So Sharp Talk has about 12,000 members. Forum Solomon Islands has about 4,000. It's a closed group, which I think is important to remember when we think about these stats. Sharp Talk's open, and so is Human Talk Talk, which has about 10,000 members. Now, these are really striking if you consider the sort of levels of internet access we were looking at before. And interestingly, online political discussion groups seem to be more a feature of political life in Melanesia than Polynesia. the Polynesian environment, as far as I can tell, and there is no research done on this, is less politically engaged, but also a little bit more fractured around local identities, anyway, which is, I think, a surprising kind of anecdotal observation. So this next slide, these are just some examples of what people are doing online politically in PNG. So up the left, this is Ralph Regenbarney's Facebook page. He's a lands minister in Vanuatu. Very active online. He uses his Facebook page, but is also active on UniTalkTalk. Uses it to engage with constituents, to discuss policy, to get feedback on policy. And then interestingly, there are MP user groups on UniTalkTalk and also on SharpTalk. There are some MPs on Forum of Solomon Islands International, but it's not sort of an organised group. I think the important thing to remember about those three groups that I showed you before is that they've all evolved into offline political associations that have been quite active in terms of petitions, protest marches, and sort of general civil society style activity. They're integrating with other aspects of offline civil society in those countries, which again is, I think, an interesting development. So the one down here to the left, this is an extract from a blog, a Fiji political blog. There's not so many of those as there used to be, but they're quite important in the context of repression of media freedom in Fiji. I'll get back to that in a sec. Up to the right here is an extract that I took last night from Sharp Talk, talking about Australia's asylum policy. I think one of the interesting things when we think about social media in the Pacific, studies have shown that studies are kind of inconclusive as to the government's impacts of social media. Does it make people more excited about politics and more likely to participate? Does it make them more cynical about politics and therefore less likely to participate? But I think what we can see, at least in terms of the discourse on Sharp Talk and the other two forums I showed you, is a national identity emerging kind of in an oppositional sense to Australian politics and regional politics. So there's also, you can see the asylum seeker issue is quite big in that discussion, and trust me, it's all over Sharp Talk and the other forums that I follow. But what you're also seeing, for example, is a lot of West Papuan politics, far more online than offline, which is, it's interesting for Australia, but also for the region, given the history of Melanesian identity, for example. So back to this example down here of the Fijian blog. In Fiji, we all know there was some pretty serious repression of media. That extended to online media, so bloggers have been harassed and arrested. But also I think what we don't talk about a lot in the Pacific is the way that governments react to online pressure. So we can see they get a bit flustered and might actually respond with some vague policy kind of changes or respond indignantly in the traditional media. There hasn't been much evidence of actual change having taken place, but that's not to say it won't. But what we also see in Fiji, at least, is governments responding actively in terms of harassing bloggers, but also astroturfing. So the Fijian government has a publicly stated policy about getting online and actively counteracting anti-regime propaganda, whether covertly or overtly. And we don't really talk about that in the Pacific. We don't talk about the legal regime surrounding online censorship, probably because there isn't really one in most Pacific states. But I think it will be an emerging issue. We've seen it erupt in the Solomons and PNG. And I think it's an issue we should possibly look at increasingly. So the takeaway, I suppose, is that access has exploded, even though there's still a long way to go. And given the context in which this increase has taken place, it's something that I think has the potential, or is groundbreaking. But the sort of the donor aspect of things has, I would say, and I'd be interested to hear from people from Aussie in the audience about what's happening, the donor aspect of things has really yet to catch up, particularly when it comes to ICT for governance. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. That was really interesting to hear about what's happening or perhaps not yet happening in the Pacific. Now we'll have Dr. Nicholas Farrelly presenting, and he's going to talk a bit more about what's happening in Myanmar. He's a research fellow at the College of Asia Pacific here at ANU. His primary academic interest in the long-term study of Southeast Asian society and politics. And he co-founded Mandala, which is a very well-known and widely read blog that looks at social, cultural and political issues in the Southeast Asian region.
Alrighty, good morning, everyone. Wonderful to be here, and a great honour, I must say, to share this panel with such a distinguished group. I'm going to be speaking about Myanmar, and I guess I'm going to start with a question. It's a question about these buzzing, whirring, constant tools. Are these going to transform democracy? They're going to lead to good governance? Are they going to allow us to provide better humanitarian response? Or is it perhaps that these weapons of the wired are, instead of being a digital game changer, something more like an empty tweet, 140 characters of nothing much at all? And I suppose for somebody who has spent so much time online, stewarding websites and monitoring the comings and the goings of the electronic ether, I'm not your standard digitopia skeptic. I guess, though, when it really comes to the crunch, I've become an unlikely advocate for the idea that whatever the merits of our socially networked world, there is, at least in the sorts of places that we're talking about today, much good reason to think of old-fashioned tools first and foremost. And what I have in mind is shovels and pens and stethoscopes and garbage cans and, yes, guns as well. In the places that I study most seriously, and for today I'm going to limit myself to a discussion of the internet and mobile phone technology in Myanmar, the mobile and internet revolution remains tentative with every chance it will not lead to the types of positive outcomes that we tend to have in mind. And to put these comments in the right context, let me begin with some quick history. And I'm very thankful here to Oren for all of his efforts to provide a very helpful overview of the situation in Myanmar today. I recall a time, literally the blink of an eye ago, when the only way to regularly get international news in Myanmar was to get your hands on an overpriced copy of one of these. Of course, you could also entertain yourself with what was often a scratchy image from the official television news. Men in uniform were and remain standard fodder. In the old days, a mobile telephone, if you could see one, was typically a tycoon's toy, the exclusive preserve of millionaires and their minions. Priced in the thousands of dollars, the government had no interest in proliferating a technology which they feared would help mobilise street mobs and lead to the anarchy of the masses. Instead, the country's flimsy mobile phone system was designed with a certain isolationist and unconnected nonchalance. The internet wasn't much better, and some of you in the room will know this very well indeed. It was expensive and erratic, and most connections were quarantined to dingy hotel foyers and teenage boy-infested internet cafes. The teenage boys, of course, spent their time playing Counter-Strike or one of the FIFA-inspired soccer games. Until, say, and this is very rough, 2008, both the internet and mobile phones were far too expensive and too limited in their range to be taken seriously as popular and political tools. This, of course, has changed very quickly. And nowadays, all over Myanmar, you can pick up stray Wi-Fi signals on pretty much every second street corner. Internet use has skyrocketed, and Oren's 2011 numbers show the baseline, and I guess that today it's somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population who have a mobile phone. Plenty more people are online. Phones are now relatively cheap, with prices comparable to Australia, and the government has recently released batches of bargain basement SIMs at barely a few dollars a pop. All of this is now circulating through a telecommunications market that was almost non-existent even half a decade ago. And people are justifiably proud of their new connections. I guess the question is, what are they doing with them? And as Oren so rightly pointed out, they're all over Facebook. And particularly the core demographic of 16 to 30-year-olds. They're constantly updating, friending, poking and doing everything else. Their efforts are part of a newly popularised effort to get online. Most of the traffic is flirtatious, gossipy, the look-at-me kind of stuff beloved of Facebookers around the world. And then when the big issues of the day, like ethnic political conflicts, start to intrude on the Facebook scene, as they inevitably do, the temptation is to get inside a partisan sectional echo chamber. The Facebook ecosystem is, of course, designed to encourage this, but at least in Myanmar, given the recent political history, the ramifications are not benign. On Facebook, for instance, and depending on who you have as friends, your list might look something like this. That striking symbol is, of course, the flag of the Kachin Independence Army, an ethnic subnationalist group that went toe-to-toe with the Myanmar armed forces from June 2011 to May 2013 in a war that probably killed 4,000 people. Kachin partisans on Facebook were making their feelings known. Such relatively subdued Kachin advocacy stands in some contrast to the situation elsewhere on the Myanmar internet. When violence between Muslim and Buddhist groups has sparked over the past year, we have witnessed an unedifying spectacle of old hate running amok in fields of so-called digital freedom. Nasty, vindictive, and utterly anti-social talk spreads quickly, gets virulent responses, and ends in cycles of recrimination and unease. And at the same time, the Myanmar government is up to some of its old habits. Nowadays, chasing a few people at least for the crime of owning a laptop and communicating with foreigners. Those who are chased are, of course, from persecuted minorities, surprise, surprise, mostly Muslims. From where I sit, I judge that a battlefield is opening in Myanmar's online space, and it's not benign. It's unclear what its potential for future and outrageous applications might be. And so for now, what I'd like to focus on is whether the hardline vitriolic sentiments are the true feelings of those who propagate them online, and do those who like and retweet and play along appreciate the real-world implications of making hate the online currency of choice. With such questions echoing around my head, I'm just going to briefly turn to three analytical matters, which I won't quite have time to do justice to here, but let's see how we go. I'll start with the positive influences. And of course, there are positive influences. And we've already heard from Matt, from Oren, and from Sarah here this morning about various ways that these technologies can be mobilised. And I accept all of that, at least up to a point. Since 2006, I've run a website that deals with some very sensitive political and social issues in the mainland Southeast Asia region. I'd like to think that it's made something of a positive impact, but I'm also very aware that in many cases its role has not been judged benign. The challenge of these technologies, to my mind, is to harness their constructive and productive power, and the ever-present danger is that they will be best mobilised and most rapidly deployed by those whose ill interests actually militate against democracy, accountability, and humanitarian goodwill. Second, there are the negative influences. And these are influences that interconnection can bring and fertilise. And I've already flagged some of these for the Myanmar case. For its internet denizens, festering sectarian or communal hatreds have been given new voices in the online sphere. And if you spend your time trawling the Burmese language message boards, you get accustomed to the vitriol and the hate. Of course, that's no different to Thailand or Australia or so many other places for that matter. And the obliteration of moderate public space and its opportunities for critical but considered dissent often becomes an online tragedy. Some people probably like to pretend that this doesn't really matter, that it's just online. I think it does. Third, this is the third element of my effort at some analysis here, there is the link between these technologies and the array of political powers that seek to control them. In Myanmar, the subversive potential of blogging, tweeting, and texting kept the old military regime on a hair trigger. The generals did, at least for a time, get in the habit of stalling the country's internet traffic just to make sure that not too much anti-government material could circulate too fast. In the years ahead, the idea that Myanmar's internet will be switched off will probably become a hazy memory, to be replaced in all likelihood by the targeted blocking and sanctioning of specific web outputs. In Myanmar, this may initially focus on pornography. I think that's a good bet. But there is every chance that it will spread to other categories of content, including social and political criticism. Finally, the challenge I think that we all face online and in our lives today is that the internet changes the equation for all political and social space. For a country like Myanmar, the winds that will buffet its shores will come from very far away indeed, including from the Qatari and Norwegian companies that were recently given the contracts to build the new telecommunications systems. So, for those of us who wish Myanmar well, as the country's political and economic transformation continues, I think it is reasonable to share some pretty serious concerns about the internet's role. Developing cultures of considerate online exchange and interaction is not easy, and I think that even in a place like Australia, we have tended to fail quite often when it comes to raising the level of online discussion. Attacks on vulnerable communities online, especially women and minorities, are a deeply regrettable hazard of our internet culture. In Myanmar, a further problem is that violent conflict continues in the real world, even if it is, I accept, at a lower intensity than in past decades. This map, this one's from 2011, shows you some of the recent hotspots. So think about all of the improvements and the transformations and contrast that with these very significant conflicts. And of course, in 2012, the conflict was even greater. And so, sadly, I'd conclude that the same hatred and bile that motivate this recent violence will drive the cliques that will, in time, make fortunes for Myanmar's internet entrepreneurs and telecommunications czars. That incentive is, as anywhere, hard to argue against, and so it's hard to imagine that Myanmar's internet will ever be a consistently happy or harmonious place. On that note, I'd like to say that I'm not convinced there is any solution to this, and that instead we will all have to come to terms in our own ways with the destructive character of some 21st century interconnectivity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Dad. It's a bit of the darker side of Facebook perhaps coming through there. I think what we're going to do now is open up for some questions. We might just take a couple of questions at a time because we do want to finish a little bit early today. Some of our guests have to get off to another meeting. So anyone?
In agricultural development and the use of mobile telephony for extension and improvement in agricultural production and productivity. And I was very interested to hear about what we're doing with markets in Fiji. So anyone can comment on an experience? I know there's low penetration into regional areas, but just very interested in that dynamic.
I might also take
a
question in the front row.
I'm very interested in the presentation about Indonesia. My question is, I see that the change is only, as we said, it's only on the humanitarian issues. But when I see the change that happened in the Jokowi-Dodo election and everything, it shows that probably the youngsters taking the account of the change itself by spreading the word through the Twitter and Facebook and everything, because I see that the political aspect is more like interested they interested to be the hip and popping issue of the youngsters in the urban area. I just want to ask your opinion about that. Thank you.
Okay. I might say something very short. Do I need
this? Yeah, if we can use those, it'd be great.
Okay, is that on? All right. I might say something very short about agricultural, but I don't have a lot to say. It's just a couple of interesting case studies, or one in particular I'm thinking of that I came across. And that is, I guess, reiterating the point about models and simply replicating them doesn't always work, and so you need to look at the process for design. One ICT model that aims to support farmers has been using SMS or mobile apps to give information about farm prices or the prices of goods in particular areas, and this has been done for quite a while and has been publicised in Kerala and a range of different places. Sometimes it works exactly how it's supposed to, and sometimes it doesn't quite do that. So the case that I'm thinking of an organization that was trying to help seaweed farmers, particularly in eastern Indonesia. And they were using this SMS, bulk SMS, to give seaweed farmers the prices so that everyone would know and they weren't getting ripped off. The problem was that seaweed prices didn't fluctuate that much. Sometimes they did, but not that much. And so the organization that was supporting this spent an enormous amount of money on bulk SMSs, and it wasn't really effective, and so they cut it. But farmers sometimes still wanted to know the prices, so they would start calling this organization. The point being that there are other tools that the organization could have used, but they didn't have the breadth of experience and knowledge. It was just off the shelf. There's interactive voice response where they could have called in whenever they needed, etc. So I think the issue is there are a range of initiatives, and maybe others on the panel can add a few others, but it's really making sure that the technical competence or literacy at the local level is able to feed into the design so that you are using the tool that makes sense for the local context. And then you can see how well it works or not. But Indonesia, I mean, Jokowi is a really interesting phenomenon. When I say that mobilization, social mobilization, happens with humanitarian motives, that's predominantly. Of course, it's not exclusive. There are examples, particularly earlier on in the transition, where before you had Facebook, email lists were used for conflict mobilization, the way that Nicholas is talking about, and there's also, you know, human rights mobilizations, but it's a much lower level. I think the emphasis really is online doesn't change people's character, whether it's positive or negative. And the kinds of mobilizations that are happening are stuff that people already want to do. Just as the kind of ethnic conflict, you know, really ugly in Burma, is the kind of stuff that people are already mobilized around. It just facilitates the mobilization. So it can create a new public sphere. It doesn't necessarily create a new public individual. And so the kind of celebrity impact of Jokowi is really interesting. I think you can see parallels in a range of countries in terms of how people use media to promote their program and go over the top of the institution, appeal straight to the public. And I think that's what Jokowi is doing politically, but he's using both conventional media and online tools to be able to do that. How far it goes in terms of changing governance models or changing campaign practice, I think remains to be seen. I'm sure everyone is looking at Jokowi and saying, how can I campaign like that? But if, you know, General Wiranto tries to campaign like that, it's not going to work. You know, so it's down to the cut. I mean, you can look at, you know, for example, even here, you know, Kevin Rudd is very telegenic and gets a better response when he goes on the small screen compared to some of the people he's campaigning against inside or outside his own party. So, you know, it's really similar features that we've seen in other media, but with different effects and different, I guess, dissemination depending on the platform. I'm sure it will change Indonesian politics somehow, but it remains to be seen how it is. It's still more celebrity than governance, but the celebrity is really giving the governance issues a lot of popularity with the YouTube videos and stuff like that.
Does anyone else have an answer? Sarah on the Pacific and Africa?
I just wanted to talk a little bit about your question about agriculture. I don't know a whole lot about it, but there's some pretty significant research showing the economic impacts of mobile phone kind of liberalisation and on countries which are dominated by smallholder agriculture like the Pacific. Some interesting examples, I think, are not just apps which facilitate access to markets, but apps which can facilitate agricultural extension programs. So there's one in Uganda, for example, that I'm thinking about, which has been rolled out in concert with a new type of watermark. And the phones are used to sort of distribute bulk SMSs to farmers to remind them to check it at a certain point in time to facilitate their learning about this new type of technology. There's another example which I think is quite interesting, which is sort of a citizen science use of the technology. So there's a new variety, I think it's in Senegal, a new variety of peanuts which is being trialed. And so the farmers have been given sort of credit so that they can report back easily on the growing conditions and the growing environment, and that way build that body of knowledge that otherwise wouldn't be as easily sort of accessible.
Should we take another round of questions back?
mentioned the importance of design and you know, behavior-centric research, etc. I'm just wondering how we can, how the panel think that we have the opportunity to influence design. Say that when designs have been conducted by people that don't have these kind of knowledge or donors that aren't really funding in this space, I'd just be interested in ways that you think you could potentially influence donors or design experts.
I'm interested in like the all the cases in Southeast Asia and Polynesian countries. Their online tools are worldwide, like Facebook or Twitter. But what about the case in China? Because Chinese government block all the Facebook, all the access to Facebook, to Twitter. Yeah, so we have our own Chinese Twitter, Chinese Facebook. So how is the mobilization of these online tools in China?
One
more question.
I was just interested in the comments that a lot of the use in Indonesia of blogging was local groups, and I was just wondering whether there was any sense at all that this was changing the characteristics of social interaction in some of these sort of regions where you've got the electronic interacting so specifically and directly with other forms of meeting, physical meeting and etc., social meeting. So I was just wondering whether the social character of these places was in any way reflecting this change.
Okay, and that brings us back to the panel. We'd like to jump in on those.
Design.
Start on some of the design. Yeah, on the design front, it's a big challenge. What we have actually found as an organization is that looking for the donors to fund us to do the design actually does not happen. So we've self-funded a lot through our own overheads and indirect funding to try to just to experiment a bit more in that field, and also to do a lot of research based on our findings. Because we do think that one of the best ways to influence kind of the community of practice, including with the donors, is, we're primarily funded by USAID, but also by the European Union and others. When you go and say that you're using your own research or your own resources to do research, it gives you an extra level of credibility because it shows that you're actually trying to learn something as opposed to just reporting out on success stories and everything else. So we find that works quite a bit, and we've been working with, we as an organization have set up a Center of Innovation and Learning precisely to do this, to put more rigor into our design. It's hard, it takes a lot of work, and when we're kind of project-driven, it actually is very hard to find the time to do the research well and to get it all the way to market, as Matt knows, waiting for us to finish our research now. but we do find that helps quite a bit, and there is real receptivity. But I think it is a long-term process in engaging with the donors and also with other organizations to explain why this should be or could be important for work they're doing in other countries. I might just talk also quickly about China, because China is so different. We have a China program which right now is training people on how to use social media in the Chinese context. Weibo is obviously the big microblogging site with 500 million users, so I think it's probably the biggest, for a single country, it has some of the most incredible numbers in terms of how people are using it. The Chinese government has committed huge resources to controlling what goes on there. I think probably if they were to look back and rethink their strategy, they might not have allowed Weibo to begin with, considering what's going on, but the genie is out of the bottle. I'm not a China expert by any stretch of the imagination, so take everything I say with a bit of a grain of salt. What I sort of see as kind of defining characteristics, again, although the Chinese government is quite successful in directing the course of dialogue, and they're very active in blocking certain terms, if they're politically hot or sensitive terms, they are quite good at blocking any searches for those. The bloggers then respond by, using a Chinese character which sounds something like it, but it's a different character. So it's kind of a cat and mouse game, which continues. I think one thing that has happened. There's what they call the human flesh search engine, which is kind of online vigilantism. It's actually quite interesting because when I talked to Chinese bloggers and people who are involved and kind of maybe a little bit more democratically minded, they actually think this is a good thing because it's the only way that they can hold government officials accountable. So they'll take pictures of a government official, they'll publish what his stated salary, for a government official, his level will be, along with a picture of a big gold Rolex. And then they'll do kind of a shaming campaign to question, well, where did you get a gold Rolex? And then he's forced to respond and say, oh, it's a fake Rolex or something like this. So there is, I think there's probably more, there's more accountability, albeit in a very small way now in China through this, but it's very ad hoc, it's not systematic, and I'm not sure that it has led to any huge changes overall. The downside is also it can be used for negative vigilantism as well, depending on, they attacking individuals who were known to have an affair, and they publish the person's name, their parents' home address, where they live, where they work, people get fired. We've seen this happen not just in China, it's happened in Thailand as well for what people have posted on Facebook. So I'd say that's kind of the downside. For sure, there are a lot more people joining the conversation in China through Weibo than I think had ever happened beforehand. And even though it is still quite tightly controlled, there's just a lot more diversity of viewpoints in a way that did not exist 10 years ago.
Design and Indonesia. Looking at the question on Indonesia. I haven't been to China, I don't research China, but I think the question highlights one point which we didn't cover, which we're all aware of, but we didn't really cover in our presentations, and that is just how is the business side of this space organized? Because a lot of the way that China is controlled is through the relationship between the government and the businesses, and what the businesses need to have a license, and just the whole regulatory environment helps to shape that level of control and the behavior on it. There are examples of that in Indonesia, far less, but even the law that put Prita in jail is an example of that, and there are upcoming laws that are far more draconian that could be passed. And they also relate to how government gives out contracts and what you need to get a contract and how you collaborate. I mean, China's an extreme example of that, but I think when we're talking about how this space is shaped, particularly around government involvement, then the licensing and the agreements between state and companies is something that we have to pay attention to. And even laws like pornography laws and how they're used to crack down on dissent and stuff like that is also a big shaper of it. That's an amorphous comment, but I think your question highlights that while China is a very particular case, there are these kinds of forces in other areas around the region as well. Looking at the blogging communities in Indonesia, it's very interesting. I mean, there has been a little bit of cultural study on that by some young Indonesian researchers, which I'm happy to share and send along. It does very much become... I mean, it kind of works both ways. The localized and formalized blogging groups in different parts of Indonesia have formed, I guess, a human infrastructure for dissemination of practice and awareness. So, for example, some of the leading technology NGOs in Indonesia, and there's only a few, but they're very effective, despite their scale, they will work with local blogging communities to hold events in different areas, to spread awareness, digital literacy, how to write a blog, how to set one up. And so it is a means of dissemination and learning throughout those networks. One of the examples is also in humanitarian practice of varying scales, some very small, some larger. But for example, the volcano in off Flores, Roquetenda, which has displaced, last I knew it had displaced around 4,000 people, 3,000 people, something like that. There are local blogging communities who wanted to respond and never had any experience in humanitarian efforts, but their networks in other blogging communities had, and they directly accessed them to find out what they could do. So there is that. But at the local level, and my research is going back a bit, so it could have evolved, there's often quite strong interaction between some of the leading local bloggers and local government. Sometimes that's positive, sometimes that's negative, but it's often around promoting local cultural identity. It can be local government inviting bloggers to come on trips to promote a local tourist destination. But it can be local bloggers mounting a campaign to protect a cultural site that the local government wants to develop. So around the localized cultural identity, there is quite a bit of, I guess, mobilization and formation there. I think that's something that's worth looking at a bit more. Some of the research I've looked at traces that back to the Suharto era and how it manipulated or tried to shape local identity and unity and diversity and all that kind of stuff. And there are definitely some trends that hark back to that. It hasn't come out of nowhere. It does come out of the previous experience of local areas. But I think it's a very interesting example of online culture and the offline background to it and how it mobilizes. I'm happy to share the very little research that I have come across. It's quite involved cultural studies, if you like.
Yeah. All right, very briefly on China, as it is relevant to a country like Myanmar, if once upon a time the generals who are running the show in the bad old days could have built a Myanmar-centered online ecosystem, they certainly would have. There's no doubt in my mind that for a brief moment they considered that and failed, naturally enough. China is perhaps the only place where a parallel strand of internet life has now emerged, and of course we're aware of its limitations. It's different, it's interesting. Myanmar, of course, and so many other places are picking up what would be the global norm, and I imagine that remains the case until the rest of us have polished up our Mandarin sufficiently that we can deal with all of the Weibo.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.